Hi, you're listening to One Way, single parent family favourites on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Stuart Lee. That was the 5678s you might have seen playing in the big fight scene at the end of Kill Bill 1, and that's a compilation album of all their early singles. And they're playing sometime soon at the Water Rats in King's Cross. I can't remember when it is, but I do have other information about accurate dates relating to other artists over the course of the next 2 hours. When we're also going to be joined by the writer Pete Bainham, whose series I'm Not an Animal is on BBC Two at the moment, and he's coming in about 12:30. He says he is, but he does tend to lie and be unreliable, so we'll see what happens. And the hits keep coming on Resonance 104.4 FM, London's volunteer staff community arts radio station. That was Morrissey's new single, English Heart, Irish Blood, or maybe it's the other way around, I can't remember. Anyway, that's from a really good new album, and the only reason it's not been getting across the board 5-star reviews is because the 30-something male critics reviewing it are locked in an Oedipal struggle with the fact that Morrissey was a father figure to their own adolescent selves. The fools. Our guests arrived, but I'm not going to bring him in yet, because I have a plan for these shows. I'm not an idiot. But you might be able to hear him snickering away there. And I'm not even going to say who he is, because I mentioned it earlier and you should have been listening.
And now, like on Anne and Nick's Good Morning, it's time for our first natural break. So please welcome, with some top recipe and lifestyle ideas, a Welsh man from Balham in South London, Peter Bainham.
Thank you very much. I'm Peter. I'm here with mainly some recipes, but also one or two other lifestyle ideas which I thought up with my brother Charlie. The recipes are all from a book which I recently tried to get published, which was sort of inspired by Delia Smith's One Is Fun. Mine was called One Is Quite Lonely, really. Delia Smith says, interestingly enough, in the introduction to her book, if you're the sort of person who enjoys pouring boiling water over instant gravy granules, then I'm afraid these recipes aren't for you. Well, I actually say the same in my book. I mean, don't worry about the boiling water. Just eat the gravy granules straight from the box, the way nature intended. Anyway, my first recipe is a simple, delicious snack for warm summer days. It's called Simple Summer Fries. The ingredients are one bag of frozen oven chips and a bowl, you see. Now, what you do is you open the bag, as I've done earlier. Then you pour the chips into the bowl, and then you eat them, like that. And that's especially delicious with a cigarette. So there you go. Now, a brief warning before I go on. Not all of the ingredients in these recipes are that easy to get hold of. And some news agents don't even stock them. So before you do anything else, find yourself a good news agent, right? Now, your news agent, you see, and the relationship you cultivate with him is very, very important. I mean, I was in my news agents the other day, and I went over to the cheese display and I picked up a piece of mature cheddar. And I said, excuse me, how would you cook this? And he said, I don't know, put it in a sandwich or something. And when I got home, I did. It was very nice. So try that when you get home tonight. Right, my final recipe for this section is what you do is you take a slice of mighty white bread, chew up some bread. Mm-mm. Don't swallow it. Just try and get it into jowls. Like a hamster would. Next, you do the same with half a Mr. Kipling custard slice. And a tablespoonful of jam. Finally, take a swig from a bottle of sherry. And there you have it. Instant trifle.
Yeah, visual humour on the radio there from Peter Bainham. 10 years ago, Pete, that was from our guest, Peter Bainham. Your voice was all high.
It was. That was the last time I was happy when I was doing that sketch on your show.
You did that character for about 4 years, and by the end, it had become a character, but that's the first recording of it, and it's very much just you speaking, isn't it?
Yes, it just sounds exactly like I speak now and how I live. So to me, it's not a character, and I'm offended that people were laughing.
I hadn't listened to that since I heard you actually say it with your mouth at the time. It was good.
I enjoyed it. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, Pete's going to be doing that again, reviving that character for the first time.
That's what it's come to.
In 9 years, on the fourth Friday, the 4th of June, at Battersea Arts Centre, well, the town hall behind Battersea Arts Centre, for a benefit to raise money for beleaguered Battersea Arts Centre, which had its funding cut, whilst the Bath Festival can bring in the whole Netherlands Wind Ensemble.
Evil.
So yeah, so you can go on the internet to Battersea Arts Centre and find out about that. If you'd like to hear that act done again by a man,
should I do some new material?
No, I don't do anything new.
Well, have I got to do the same things? I thought about thinking of a new recipe or something.
What's changed? We need this character that was based on a man who ate mainly what he could find in the newsagents. How's that changed in 10 years, do you think?
What, that character?
Well, no, how, if you were to approach living that lifestyle now, how would
it be
different?
I think the big difference would be, because originally wasn't it something like, it ended up as recipes for the single man of 30 who lives in Balham with his brother Charlie,
yeah.
and the only difference now would be the single man of 40
right.
who lives with his brother Charlie.
But I think, don't you think that, I mean, a lot of news agents now have a much wider range of foods in them.
They do, yeah. I mean, the trouble is now, if you went to a news agent now, the absolute Valhalla of amazing riches that you see, you know. Ginster's pasties have moved on hugely, haven't they?
Yeah, you know? Well, I mean, they were very conscious about rebranding them, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And crisps, you know, crisps are just astonishing.
You can't get ordinary old-fashioned crisps now. They have all pictures of fruit and vegetables on the outside. Don't they? And funny names and stuff.
Yeah.
So in a way, you know, while you've stood still with your notions, society has society's moved on.
Oh dear. I must think of something though. I must go down to the news agents and
go and have a cursory.
I've changed now, Stu. You see.
I know.
I live on. Yeah, just get, you know. Do you think Peter should have developed incredibly expensive tastes and, you know, instant caviar and things?
Well, I think you're making basically that would be a different character, wouldn't it?
Yes.
And you also can't afford to make the assumption after such a long gap that anyone will go, how interesting that he's changed.
That's amazing. He's subverting that
something
quite basic
I can't
act
remember.
That sounds great. That's like something Morrissey would do.
I know, but you're saying, you know, what would Peter live on now? And what caviar and whatever, but you, that character.
That's such a crap assumption of somebody who's made money, isn't it? Oh, probably caviar and gold. And
yeah, gold food.
You'd lick caviar off lumps of gold.
Well, I expect that's what you do now, isn't it? Because it's all very well 10 years ago when you were doing that, but your life's changed, hasn't it?
No,
because
I do.
It is
like
you're
that.
A top. You are now.
No,
you've written Alan Partridge series and all sorts of things, and you've got this thing on BBC Two now. Yeah. I Am Not an Animal.
I know, that's just a cartoon, though.
It's what cartoons of the new film. Puppets are the new cartoons.
Yes.
Cartoons are the new films.
Yeah, that's right. The films are the new puppets.
Yeah, it goes in a kind of cycle. Now the thing is, right? Because you were supposed to come in before and didn't, I've not watched that programme.
Right.
I haven't seen it because I've been working.
Right.
But so now I need to ask you about it, but I can only do it in the style of a local radio DJ whose show you've gone on, who's read a press release and doesn't know anything about
That's fine. Go ahead.
So, okay, this is how it would go if this was Radio WM.
Shall I react as I would react
to
that DJ?
Do your absolute best to be polite.
And will you be laughing at loads of things?
No, what I'll be doing is not listening to what you're saying and looking at the girl in the control box and then giving you a cursory glance back when I think you've finished answering. And the next question I ask will not have taken on board any of the information you've given me, because that's how they tend to work.
Okay. I'll cut my cloth according to your performance style then.
Okay, so we're joined by Peter... That is Bainham.
Bainham, yes.
And he is a comedy writer. He's written for all of... he's written everything Steve Coogan's done, and he's got a new series on called I'm Not an Animal. Now, let me get this straight, Pete. This is a cartoon about animals.
Yes.
And they are in a vivisection laboratory.
Yes.
Where did you come up with that bad idea? It's insane.
When I was working in a vivisection laboratory,
Oh, yeah.
And I just had this idea I'd cut up animals
coffee,
all day.
Yeah, thanks.
And All right.
No, carry on.
That joke I was just trying to do.
Yeah. Do it again.
And actually, you cut across to the point where somebody listening might actually think, oh, he did work in a vivisection laboratory.
Right.
No, I had the idea from reading Animal Farm originally, and almost deliberately missing the point that it was meant to be an allegory when the pigs stood upright,
yeah,
and they two legs good, four legs bad, and all that. And I started to just get pathetic amusement from the fact that if pigs did actually get the sentient ability to want to stand up, then how would they actually stand up? Because presumably they'd need harnesses or crutches.
Yeah, well, and different bones, different bone structure.
Yeah.
But George Orwell, he didn't care about
things. He didn't care
like
about
that.
He doesn't think it through, no. George Orwell. He was fundamentally a lazy, and I think I could quite safely say the worst writer there's ever been.
I mean, no, I agree with you.
We'd be sued by his estate.
No, no.
Okay, then.
Right. He was the worst writer, and you're better than him, aren't you?
I am better than him.
Because you've thought about how...
I know it doesn't work in print. Does it work
on
a community
base? Let's face it.
Doesn't it? Okay.
No. But, I mean, you've thought about how a pig's back works, and George Orwell just didn't do that.
No. And he hid behind the cloak of, oh, it's about society or about the future or something like that.
Meanwhile, you're going, what about a pig's bones?
What about a pig's bones? And I'm just trying to sort of, I'm standing up and I'm saying, you look, see it through, George. You know, and I think, what was his real name? Harry Webb, wasn't it?
No, that's Cliff Richard.
Okay. Reg Dwight.
What?
Eric. Eric, no. Tony, Eric Arthur Blair.
Eric Arthur Blair.
Blair, see,
clues in the name.
Blair, Tony B. Liar.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, having got to the point where you thought, well, if a pig was given the sentient ability to stand up, A, it couldn't. Cause it would actually, there's a really good book by an American writer called Kirsten Bockris, and you know what? I'm sure you haven't read it, but it's called Lives of the Monster Dogs.
All
and
right.
It's about dogs that are bred in labs to be super intelligent and be soldiers and stuff. And then they, when they're no longer needed, they end up living in penthouses in New York. It's great.
All right.
But that actually,
I haven't read.
No,
that.
I know. And you know what? It's a great first novel. 10 years ago, nothing happened to it afterwards. But she actually did address that thing of they all get arthritis and get like bendy backs and become kind of crippled from trying to emulate people and walk around.
Well, that's what they do in this, is because when they go out into the wild, they then find things like the dog finds like a Zimmer frame to strap herself into so she can walk upright, and the horse, Philip, is obsessed with sitting down in a chair, and he just wants the simple human dignity of being able to sit down, and so he gets the monkey to sort of build to fit pulleys in the ceiling so he can be, and he's got this bizarre thing which is he uses a sundial as a counterweight to actually lift him into a chair, and that gave me pathetic amusement.
Going back into local radio question mode,
of course,
now.
Yes.
Of course, I became really interested and I forgot I was trying to be rude. But, the thing about running for animation, presumably, Pete, is you can let your imagination go wild and you're not constrained by actors or what
that's
can be.
That's not true.
Is it not?
No, because, the animals, if I let it literally not be constrained, then one would. The animals could all be steel or something like that, or have one eye or something like that, But now they've still got to, you still try and follow some sort of storyline that will draw people along, So you're still ruled by the laws of storytelling.
Okay, it's me again now.
Okay.
All right. What about
you should do a very distinct voice for the.
I know. Yeah. But it's nearly as good as your from 9 years ago. Was the idea that by giving them human personalities, and the idea is presumably they've been given human brains for kind of research purposes or human personalities, was that just a way basically of looking at all the things that you find banal about people's reactions to culture and transposing it onto animals from thence the humour arises?
Yes.
So what stuff did you think, well, I hate having heard a person say this, I'll put it into the mouth of a chimp?
Well, the chimp specifically is actually not that clever as a character. He's just a monkey who pleasures himself. Because the thing was that I thought it'd be funny for them to, the monkey to be dependent on focaccia and wine.
Yeah.
But because he's still fundamentally a monkey, then he's just got an irresistible urge to play with his genitals. And actually, I watch out in the series, I'm expecting there must be a letter from a zoologist somewhere, because we've just deliberately given him ludicrously oversized genitals, which I'm sure are not, accurate in any way.
I was talking to the actor Kevin Eldon the other day, who does the voice of the, of the monkey, and he was saying he had a number of quite drawn out design meetings about exactly what form the monkey's genitals would take.
Yeah,
and did you sketch them out and give them to the artists, or was it more of a collaborative thing?
As an attack on the consumer society, I kept saying make it bigger,
right?
And it's actually jointed and it animates quite beautifully. Yes,
right.
But it's I quite enjoyed the naughtiness of thinking you couldn't have in a 10 o'clock sitcom on BBC Two. You probably not in the near future will have a naked man running around, but. But if anyone was to write in and go, that's disgusting, you would go, oh, but it's allowed on David Attenborough.
Yeah.
But, oh, you won't permit it. You know.
But David Attenborough
didn't
artificially try and make the monkey's genitals larger than they are, did they? He didn't.
Has my argument fallen to pieces?
Fair on him, he didn't do that.
Yeah, but you're letting him off too lightly from what he's done.
What, to raise people's awareness of ecological issues across the globe? Yeah.
Yeah.
What's he about, Hitler? So what happens now? Actually, we'll play some music, and I'm going to ask you some complicated, serious questions about the notion of the show. It's 10 to 1, and that's the time, whenever I'm hosting this show, when I always play a Fall record. That's the Fall, Kick a Conspiracy, the first rock football record of the 80s, before it was trendy. And trivia fans might like to know that the Fall's early 80s manager, Richard Thomas, who appears in the video for that as a sports reporter, is now the man who hosts the Vox and Roll literary evenings that happen in the garage, in the cafe at the garage in Islington. So you could go in there and you could perhaps pretend to recognise him from his cameo appearance in that. And see what kind of effect that has. In fact, knowing it, we go, oh, yeah, that was me. And that will kind of be the end of that. We're with Peter Bainham, the writer and performer who's got I'm Not an Animal on at the moment. Now, Pete, how did it come about that you were... I mean, is that an expensive procedure, the animation thing?
This wasn't any more expensive than a normal light-end show, because the technique we used... where, you know, at this very basic level, it's some pictures stuck together, but then shot into a computer, but, like, then gone mad. It uses a sort of digital photographic cutout technique that doesn't cost absolute millions. No?
Right. So it's not been a huge, massive financial risk to blow it around. It's not like when they go, oh, let's do some animation, everyone goes, oh, yeah, but it costs £8 million a second or whatever.
Well, I mean, we did try. When we first had the idea, we went and saw sort of proper CGI, you know, all the sort of Toy Story type animation people. Yeah. And they said £10 million for a series. And they said, we're doing you a deal here, £10 million. And we did actually offer it to the BBC at that cost.
Right.
And the BBC went quite quiet for quite a long time until I think they just froze us out. And then we went back and said, all right, we'll do it like this instead,
with some glue.
Yeah. But I mean, it's weird because it did cost a light-end show costs, but I suppose for animation it's quite cheap and everything. But I mean, I really, really like
it. Looks
the
really
look
great.
Of it now.
It's completely got. I mean, I've seen the clips. I've seen it's got a completely distinctive look. It doesn't look anything else.
Yeah, it's quite. You know, we've deliberately. You know, I mean, I've really got into the notion that we've got much better at the technique, and but I still like the fact that the horse has still clearly got stuck on human eyes. If he turns his head, like, to the left or the right, you can see the edges of his, you know, his human eyes stuck on. But I mean, I think they're very expressive.
Well, that's really important, because I think with all that kind of stuff, what people like to see is some element of human craftsmanship in it, which is why Ray Harryhausen's stop-frame animation models for old Jason and the Argonauts film are actually better than... you respond more warmly to them than you do to CGI Incredible Hulks, because... Although that was pretty good, actually. But because you can sort of see that someone made it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you get to a point where it feels entirely computer-generated, you kind of feel a weird distance from it, I think.
I know, we did it... When we did this test, because when we first went to these CGI people, we did sort of... They did do a test for us for nothing. And I've still got it, and occasionally I get it out and... First of all, I almost cry because I think, oh, that looks amazing. I mean, because it is this horse in a sort of, you know, they've put him in a little kind of voiceover studio.
Yeah.
And he looks so grand and so impressive. But then I think it's not that charming. It doesn't look, you don't look at it and go, ah, or whatever. But there's something quite tragic about a horse who, you know, because the character of the horse in our show really takes himself seriously. And the idea of a horse with stuck-on eyes thinking he's a literary genius is sort of, you know, funnier, I think.
Yeah, it is, but it's better. I mean, we actually went through the same thing with some animations on a theatre thing I've been working on, where when it got upgraded, the producers wanted to kind of replace what were basically cut-and-paste things that the designer had made and then moved about himself with something more slick. And the more slick thing was just loads worse, and we had to fight to get it back. And I actually knew it would be, and the whole thing was a waste of everyone's time and money. Because it wasn't that it was bad, it's just that it didn't have the emotional pull, because it felt inhuman on some level. What happens now for... at what point... Are you caught up in a problem about the fact that the head of BBC Two's changed, and is anyone looking after it? Because I know that Sean Locke's sitcom 15 Stories High has been caught in a kind of weird limbo between... Well, they've put two out back-to-back and then said... They said to him, if it gets X amount of viewers, you know, we'll bring it forward earlier or whatever, you know. But
Well, they haven't said anything like that to us. I mean, I'm not complete, you know, I'm just keep my fingers crossed, whatever, that they keep it where it is, you know. And you know, these it's a scary thing when anything goes out, isn't it? And it feels more so than, say, 10 years ago, where it just seems that whatever they say, you do get this slight fear that, oh no, that you know, what if it doesn't perform to the point that they want it to perform? And because, you know, because especially with something like animation, you know, people are going to be sort of slightly resistant to animation when it first comes out. And the impression I've got when I've spoken to people, you know, when the first of ours went out, is that like the first 10 minutes they were just kind of going, what?
Yeah, I'm bewildered by these moving shapes.
But I mean, I know for a fact, I'm just, you know, I know I'm biased, obviously, but as you get more used to it, you get more and more into the characters. And I think, you know, the hope is that you just let things find an audience. Yeah. So, you know.
Well, that was a really great quote from Andy Hamilton when he kind of left in a fury from writing for television, and he said that the problem was things were decided by focus groups, and he said good comedy is an ambush. Now, I don't really like or know anything he's done, but that is a great phrase. Great comedy is an ambush, because the idea that you have to take an audience by surprise and give them something they actually weren't expecting, and then they might like it. But if you, like, for example, on that that one where Dawn French and Catherine Tate are living in the kind of Wild West. Now, the first series, they're obviously supposed to be lesbians, right? And they're sleeping in a bed together, and it's kind of never made explicit. But and then the writer of that, Simon Nye, was told by the focus group that lesbians weren't playing well with the...
Really?
So in the second series, you'll notice they've been de-lesbianised and given...
What, separate rooms and
everything? Well, I know, they've got boyfriends, right?
Right.
But actually, the BBC One audience should have lesbians rammed down their throat until they... I mean, it's just kind of... The fact that a focus group responds badly to it is not a reason to not do it.
Well,
you never make any kind of breakthrough.
A nice review for ours at the beginning said something like, in an admiring way, said, you know, have the BBC forgotten that they're meant to test this stuff on BBC Three, is what they said.
Yeah, I just read that,
I was really pleased about that, and I thought, well, I hope they're pleased with that, you know, because, I mean, if I was, you know, running the BBC or running BBC Two, you know, you'd want to be protected from the accusation that it's completely, you know, that sort of thing. But I mean, they have really, you know, they've put it where it is.
The irony is,
you
could do a lifestyle show, though, couldn't you? You could do actual normal BBC Two programming with your cooking.
You could do that.
Lifestyles and makeovers.
Could I be the Dermot Gavin of?
Dermot Gavin, who's that? It's a name you've made up.
He's a shouting man who does the Chelsea Flower Show or something like that.
Oh, right.
He's the Gordon Ramsay, I think.
Have you ever been to the Chelsea Flower Show?
No, is it good?
I have, yeah. I've been twice. Because I used to work in horticulture. I used to be a horticultural researcher, as you know.
I did.
Did you not know that?
The only thing I know is that you worked in an orange juice factory and found maggots.
I worked in Kew Gardens in the library. Checking facts for a book.
Right.
But sometimes I was able to cut myself little freebie deals.
What, really?
Like...
You're corrupt.
Like getting into a flower show. And
twice.
That was where the rot set in.
Have you got contacts in the flower kingdom?
the kingdom of the flowers. Well, not so much contacts as subjects. I'm considered its king. that any flower show, from the highest one in the land to just a regional one.
You never have to say, "Don't you know who I am?" No. At a flower show.
No, I'm always let in because of.
I'm like that with the Merchant Navy.
I know you were in the Merchant Navy, weren't you? You've had a checkered career.
I know.
It's got over two different things in it. Nearly,
You know, there's the the part of my. It was the Merchant Navy and TV. So one of it is the part of my life which involved. Racist men with tattoos, sodomizing me, and the other one was the Merchant Navy.
Hey, nice. Sorry, I cut you off again there. That's so annoying.
You went back into natural.
Yeah, I know. Well, how did your experiences in the Merchant Navy prepare you for writing
cartoons?
Writing cartoons about speaking laboratory animals.
One of the reasons I left the Merchant Navy was that there was an appalling lack of training for the animation industry within, and I campaigned throughout my entire career for some sort of basic graphics course, at least, or some sort of training in.
And you know what they have there now, don't they?
What's that? They have that now. Yes, they have sat nav, so you don't have to use sextants.
No,
you don't have to scour the heavens for stars. But they also have a 6-month intensive course where you learn to sort of you learn basic animation techniques.
Jan Svankmajer was in the Merchant Navy.
It's got a stranglehold. He did it after you. He did. Yeah. I think what it is that it appealed to him because ships take a long time to get anywhere.
Like you said,
ships are the animation of the transport kingdom.
Right. How long were you in the Merchant Navy then?
5 years.
5 years. And how long have you been working on I'm Not an Animal?
17 years. No. 18. Well. On and off 3 years, but actually only 18 months fully.
Because I remember you mentioning it a long time ago an idea, and I thought, that's insane. That'll never. He'd have to be mad. Pete's brought in a mini disc of people like improvising in the studio trying to do voices for the show, but we have to work out how to use that. So while we do that, we'll run a couple of tracks together. Anyway, we're joined by Peter Bainham, who's been writing this I'm Not an Animal program, and you've kindly brought in an unusual artifact which obsessed comedy nerds who are taping this program.
I love the idea of it being an artifact.
Well, they'll be going mad at the thought of this. So tell us what it is.
Well, in our last show, Hugh the monkey, who specializes in talking rubbish and playing with himself, you sort of get an explanation as to why he talks such rubbish, and he confesses to the others, or he says excitedly that men used to come into his room back at the lab and sort of chop bits off his brain, and leaving a hole in the top of his skull where he could put his finger, and so he likes, and then he basically then horrifies the animals by pushing his finger right into his brain. And this is a very loose version of the bit when he just pushes his finger into his brain. So it got edited severely down from
You were getting the actor Kevin Eldon to try and make the sound of what
and
that would be
brilliant.
Like.
And he's brilliant, and he's really, really...
Putting a finger into your own brain.
Yes, indeed, yes. And he did that by actually drilling a small hole into his brain.
The level of commitment of a man is amazing. This is a weird edit of that.
This is a weird edit of, and we ended up, we couldn't use all of this. Right. And probably just as well. It's nice.
We can use
very
all of it.
Nice.
Here it goes.
Watch!
We explode!
No!
Yeah.
No one here!
Hello! Yes! An Arab!
Hello!
Well done.
Thank you.
An Adam!
Hello. Like, well done.
A nice mix of a track from Keiji Haino's new album of, uncharacteristically for him, acoustic guitar instrumentals, which is called Hikari Yami Ushito Kenshi Konohibiki, mixed in with a mini-disc brought in by the writer Peter Bainham of the actor Kevin Eldon, doing his idea of what a monkey would sound like if it put its finger into a hole in its own brain. And that is a unique piece of radio programming here on Resonance 104.5, London's Frontier Staff Community Arts radio station. You're listening to Stuart Lee on One Way Single Parent Family Favourites. Pete, that was great. That it was really amazing to hear that. I love those edits.
I knew that those two would collaborate eventually. It was only a matter of time.
Without their knowledge.
And they didn't disappoint, did they?
No, it works. It's it lent a lyrical quality to the to the monkey impression, that that guitar underscore. And I think that
I don't know, I think there's some who might feel that it's spelled spoiled. The avant-garde sort of, you know, the sort of slightly futuristic flamenco of the Japanese
guitarist. But neither party benefited from that.
It's quite funny. It sounds at times like the monkey was being tortured with guitar strings, steel guitar strings, pushed into his head.
Yeah, you're down as Do you mind talking about this show more? You're right.
No. Okay. No.
You're
fine.
You're down as director on it, right?
Yes.
And how do you presumably, unlike working with human people in real time on stage or in a TV studio, you can just infinitely shift those little characters around to find exactly the comic timing you want. But I wonder if that limitless range of possibilities is in itself problematic.
It is problematic, and it is definitely the way of madness.
Right.
You are God in your strange little world, and our strange little world was an animation studio in Stony Stratford outside Milton Keynes. And it was, I absolutely loved it once I got some sort of control of it, but it is mad because you are always sitting there with a thing called you make this thing called animatic,
right?
Which is like, it's basically the voice track set against still pictures. And it's a bit like the nearest thing it is to. Do you remember when Blue Peter used to do 4p renditions of things like the Battle of Hastings, and they would have a picture of a king with an arrow in his eye, and it'd just be a drawing, and somebody going, and him going, ah! And that's what an animatic is. You basically take the entire storyboard and you shoot it with a rostrum camera into the computer, and then you find the comic timing with that. That's the most important part of the whole process, because then you can shift the voice track either way to try and find the best comic timing between audio lines delivered, but then you can shift the picture as well, and that completely. I once, for our fifth episode, I actually, towards the end, when we were way over time on it, I found myself sitting at the computer playing with the animatic for a solid. I didn't leave the computer for 36 hours, and I was there all night.
And were you just obsessing over one little bit?
Oh, tiny bits, and things
what
like
was
moving.
It?
Oh, it was something like Mark the Bird's. You know, when he first hears his single on the radio, he releases a song on the internet. And,
right.
You know, a terrible, terrible song called Why Do You Reject Me? You Know I'm Full of Diseases.
Right.
And he releases the song on the internet. And then he goes mad and sinks into a terrible depression. And then comes out of bed a week later, having fallen into alarmingly accurate clinical depression and seeing no purpose to his life. And then he hears his song on the radio. And I did, in that, probably go slightly mad myself.
What was the actual tiny moment that you were were chasing there?
Oh, just loads of them.
Oh, loads of them.
All over the episode. Because the thing is that if you say to, you know, if you're directing an actor, you know, you can say, can you do that a bit quicker? Or can you do this? Or can you think about this? But the thing is, you can't do that quite often in animation because you've got one person doing the storyboard, one person doing the voice, one person, you know, drawing, you know, doing the animating, or 10 people doing the animating. And so the only way to keep a control over the whole thing is at this animatic stage. Is to kind of, and I sort of found myself glued to, you know.
So you must have spent a lot of time working with those animators.
Yeah.
Are they your friends now? Or
they are my friends. They are friends and sometimes my enemies. But no, they're really into it, you know.
Yeah.
Because the thing about this was that we did it, we from the very beginning, one of the reasons we did it the way we did it was that we wanted to do it in this country. Because, you know, an awful lot of animation is sent out to places like Bulgaria.
Yeah, well, you know, it's weirdly not dissimilar kind of exploito system to Nike or something.
Yeah.
I mean, The Simpsons is all farmed out to Taiwan where tiny children draw it in. Draw it in hovels and get paid.
Wouldn't
it
be libelous to say they quite often die whilst they're drawing?
They're whipped
and Matt Groening
until they finish.
Laughs when he hears of.
Yeah, and he takes great pleasure in the suffering that he creates, and that is why
he portrays it in further.
That's episodes. Why he's carried on making it for so long.
Right.
But no, it is true that they knock it all out over there, don't they? And then, and you know, it's sort of there's no.
Yes.
It's obviously undercutting things to some point, but you know. You didn't do that. You didn't. You can put your hand on your heart and say it wasn't made using sweatshop labour.
No, well, it was, but in Britain.
Right.
You know, we used tiny children in Milton Keynes, who, you know, that were much like soot-faced Dickensian chimney sweep boys. You
right.
know, sort of like, can I do you a bit more animation, sir? But no, I mean, the thing is that, it was partly the moral thing, but it was also that you can, you know, if you do animation abroad, as well as that cheap labour thing, is that if it comes back, if it's sent all the way to Korea, and then it's sent all the way back and it's terrible, you can't, you know, it's quite hard to persuade them to do it again, you know. But here you can just say, can you make the monkey's hand go down to his groin?
Faster,
please. Yeah. Technical things like
or
that.
Or slower.
Yes.
Or
a combination
in a different
of the two.
Way. What, is it a procedure you'd want to use again to do comedy?
Yeah.
Would you do a second series involving these characters, or is that that story? You don't feel that story hasn't played out yet?
No, I don't think so. Because the thing was that
I don't know what happens at the end, though.
Oh well, I mean, in the end, they sort of pine for their home, and they may or may not go back to their lab, and then they may or may not leave the lab again, you know. But the thing was that the actual lab setting was only ever a sort of beginning of, like, it was a sort of, you know, I just wanted to do animals that wanted to be people and a horse that wanted to wear trousers.
Yeah.
And that's all I ever wanted.
You needed a framing device for that.
Yes. And so then we worked back and said, all right, so they're made in a vivisection laboratory. But the thing about that is that then, you know, when, you know, it didn't stop us getting publicity, but that was what was focused on. And in fact, it's like a kind of ensemble comedy, really.
Yeah. Like, well, you always talk about it in terms of Dad's Army.
Yeah, I mean, it's dangerous, that, isn't it, really? Because I'm not comparing it at all. Because, you know, to say, this is the new Dad's Army, which you could now clip out and not have my set up to it, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's that.
I believe
that,
it was
for
I myself who said it was the new Dad's Army.
I believe it was. But, I mean, you know, you just want that thing of, like, just some idiots, a group of idiots trying to cope with, you know, coping in the wild, which, you know, is a loose definition of Dad's Army, but, you know, they're just old men, aren't they? And, you know.
And is that, what's your next thing that isn't
an animation?
Animated animals?
I don't know. I've been writing a film for a while.
What's that about?
Which, that's about a prime minister who runs away.
Right.
He gets the job of prime minister and wants
it all
his life.
Wish he has run away.
Yeah.
For the moment.
I think, yeah.
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 Anyway.
You've got to be careful with comments like that, Stu.
All right, okay.
You should rein that kind of stuff in. But yeah, so in this film, he's a sort of young Blair type, and very sort of confident and young, and has been groomed for number 10. And he gets the job of number 10, and that's all he's ever dreamt of. And then he gets into power, and 6 months afterwards, he's an absolute emotional wreck, and climbs out of a toilet window at a service station and literally runs away.
Yeah, there was an Australian prime minister that went missing, wasn't there? He found his clothes on a beach and he never...
Oh, that was... That was... Oh, God, I'm old enough to know this.
Right.
Which was a bloke called... No, not John Silkin, but some guy. He was a British MP.
Here as well, yeah.
Yeah. No, and it happened as weird because it happened the same time as the fall and rise of Reginald Perrin, and it all got mixed up.
Yeah, which began with that image of clothes on a beach, yeah. Mm.
Regular lifestyle tips giver. I'll try and describe him for you. If you can imagine a sort of the bastard love child of Don Estelle and Windsor Davis from Ain't Half Hot Mum, with sort of the Welsh voice from Windsor Davis and the rest from Don Estelle, then you'll have a pretty good idea of what he's like. He's a Welsh man from Balham. He's called Peter Bainham. Please welcome him.
Hello, I'm Peter. And I'm back with some more recipes and some lifestyle problem solutions from me and my brother Charlie, who lives 3 miles away, walks to my flat every night and then sleeps on my jeans in the kitchen. He's too tired to walk back. I've had a lot of letters to the show asking about Charlie, but then most of them have been from Charlie, who gets a bit confused sometimes. Anyway, we've thought up lots of tasty treats this week, such as fizzy curryade, which is the curry juice left over from a beef curry with a fenzik dropped in it. If you can't afford fenziks, or if Charlie's eaten them all, then just push a straw in the curry and blow in it. Right. Anyway, here's our first recipe, and it's a delicious warming meal for winter nights. What you do is take one OXO cube and eat it. And that's called an OXO cube. Right. Now for this week's lifestyle idea, and this is about having a drink. Obviously, pubs are too expensive and a bit scary, so what we do is we go to the off-licence, buy a few cans, and drink them in there. It's not as crowded as the pub, and you can lean on the counter by the nuts and sort of have a chat with the man behind the till. I think he likes us, actually, because he keeps going around the back and laughing out loud. Of course, they haven't got any fruit machines or anything in the off-licence, like in a pub. But what you can do is stand facing the wine section and then close your eyes and get Charlie to line up 5 bottles which are exactly the same make. Then open your eyes and they're all the same and Charlie gives you 10 pence. Next, here's a nice way to start the day. A jar of tartar sauce. My main recipe is called practical pasta. This involves a minimum of fuss and is for people like me who haven't got a pan. Would you like to help me with this one, Richard and Stuart? Yeah. What you need is a packet of pasta, hard pasta like this. Now what you do is you take a piece of hard pasta from the packet.
Yeah.
There you go. And you put it in your mouth.
In my mouth.
Yeah. Then leave it there for about 20 minutes. Until your spit makes it go soft. Then you swallow it.
Okay.
This recipe is much easier with these little pasta twirls that they have, and not spaghetti, which is too long and sort of cuts the back of your throat, as Charlie found out last week. If you can't be bothering waiting for 20 minutes, just crunch a pasta up like an extra strong mint. And that recipe works for coffee, ready breck and stewing steak, which are all in the meals you can make in your mouth section of mine and Charlie's recipe book idea, One is Quite Lonely. Right, before I go, I'd like to talk about something which I know a lot of people must suffer from, which is what to do if you've been too tired to clean out your mouse's cage and he's covered in little mouse poos. What you do is pretend that the pellets are actually loads of really small sausages and he's really looking forward to eating them later. Thank you.
Pete Bainham's been with us. Thanks for coming in.
That's all right.
And talking about your work. And
I like it described as my work.
It is your work. That is your work, that is. What you, that was a bit of another clip of you there. Mm. Did you recognise yourself?
I did recognise myself. I thought the voice had... Sorry.
Yeah.
I thought the voice had got us slightly more.
It has. Well, that
like
was
Peter.
About a month later.
All right. You'd so worked developed.
Yeah, you developed the character. And
I'd lived with stinking homeless men as research, like Daniel Day-Lewis.
How many more weeks of another 3 weeks of I'm not an
four?
Animal.
Well, actually, including Monday, 4 more weeks.
Another 4 weeks, and that's on Mondays at 10, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. And then if you like it, write in and go, I love that, keep make it again.
Please don't go on holiday or enjoy yourself in the sunshine for the next 4 weeks. I'm praying for rain, basically.
Stay
sorry about that.
Glued to that that screen. Mm. Like I said, Pete is reprising that that recipe-making character on the 4th of June. At Battersea Arts Centre, at benefit for Battersea Arts Centre. Mm. And also on that night is Arnold Brown, who invented alternative comedy. Richard Thomas and A.D. Gromit doing musical opera comedy stuff. Catherine Tate, Lee Mack, and that kid who's from, does pop programme on Channel 4. Simon Amstel.
Oh, yes.
You've seen him, he's funny. Mm, mm. And I think that's it. Oh, and Harry Hill headlining, and that's on the 4th of June, and there's about 200 tickets left. And I'm on as well then. Just to take us up to the end of the show, first of all, this is... now, who's this, Pete? You brought this in.
Oh,
the Celebrity Squares.
I haven't heard this yet. I hope it's okay to play this. But
I'm
this
sure
is,
it'd be fine.
Willie Dowling, who does our music.
Right.
With Pete Bakey, who was in Absolutely. But they do our music. They do fantastic music for I'm Not an Animal. And this is Willie Dowling's band, The Celebrity Squares.
Right.
And he gave me the CD. So I haven't heard it yet.
Okay, so we'll play that. I'm going to do like a run of tracks. If this was commercial radio, we'd go 15 minutes of uninterrupted tunes or something like that. So we'll start with that. Mm-hmm. The Celebrity Squares, Happy. Then I'm going to go into a little recording of the guitarist Derek Bailey reading a poem about his biographer, Ben Watson. And then a track of Derek collaborating with the Japanese group Ruins that should take us up to the end of the show. And that's reminded me that I need to ring Ben Watson, who also presents a show on Resonance, because he's written this biography of Derek Bailey and it's out soon. And he did say he'd come on the show. So I need to call him up and get him in next time I'm programming it. I'm in on the 20th of June with David Quantock and Pete Sargent. We're doing all three of us together. And then on the 4th of July, I haven't got any, don't know who I'm doing yet, but look forward to the 18th of July when I'll be joined by Mike Pitts, editor of British Archaeology magazine, who'll bring in some field recordings made inside burial chambers and places like that. So this was One Way Single Parent Families. I've been Stuart Lee. We were joined by Peter Bainham. Thanks for coming, Pete.
Thank you, Stuart.
Next week, Pete Sargent's here. I don't know who his guests are, but I'm sure it'll be great. And this is a track we've never heard by the Celebrity Squares.